All right, so we're starting up with Sefer Charis Part 2. Very exciting. I just want to make a comment on the controversy we spoke about last week. Rav Milam's big hesser, I guess you could say, about Na Bar Na, about Sefer Charis, saying that this has changed. The way Shechter likes to say it's a new sip in Shulchan Aruch. We're dealing with a different reality than what they're used to, what they were dealing with back then. We have hot running water, we have soap, and therefore we're able to get rid of whatever the bleos might have been, obviously not fully absorbed into the kli, just like there's a grime on the outside, and therefore a lot of these demons kind of fall away. He says that Ashkenazim can be as makel as most makel tzvardim, as we revive his sheet up when it comes to Nafar Nat, and it says by Zebra Targus that it doesn't really do overtaste anymore. So I was reading a little bit more in this newspaper, Tina Alapha, Kasher Spade, and it seems, I'm not sure why it didn't come out of like the actual section of Zebra Targus, but it seems like he rolls it back a little bit and says it depends on the material, it depends on what the kli is made out of. When you're dealing with everything that we spoke about last week, is when you're dealing with metal kalim, which I think is pretty classic. Knife. Has anybody seen a knife that's not made out of metal?
Yeah.
Okay, ceramic knife, solid. I made a knife out of wood, so I guess that would apply also. But he says, for metal, everything we spoke about is true. There's no real blia, it just doesn't work. We know we're able to clean it much better. So metal, those kulos would apply according to the Malamed. We said we really wouldn't be knowing that way. Ravenar said he wasn't comfortable passing that way, even the Yevet, even in the case of Hesed, maybe it's a sniff, but he was not so comfortable with it. He said he understood it. Bamet seems to be true, but he wouldn't go like that in the sack. When it comes to other materials, such as wood, or plastic, or ceramic, clay cheres, anything like that, pottery, then there are bleos. Rav Milam seems to say that there we do have the possibility of really something being absorbed, and then having a plate of the taste then coming out with the application of heat or with the application of a dover cheres, so those demon would still apply. So it's not as nearly as controversial as we thought. It doesn't throw in the stiff out of the Shulchan Aruch. It just depends on the material. Most knives, I think, are made out of metal, but there are others. There are situations where it wouldn't apply. Okay, we had a couple more things we wanted to talk about within Dabar Chariv. And then I just want to talk a little bit about what other topics you want to cover. If you guys have things specifically that you would want to cover, let me know and I can put them together and we'll present them for this year. So like we said, this is Siman Sadi Vav in Yoredeya. Everything that all the sources that we're basically dealing with is the eighth parak of the Masechta Tefillin. The Gemara was the same Gemara as Na Bar Na. It was the continuation. The Na Bar Na was Dagim Sha'olu B'Ta'ara. You're allowed to eat those fish with kuta, with that Babylonian milky dip. However, if you cut sinon, if you cut a radish with a flashic knife, that radish is flashic and cannot be eaten with the milk fish. Rashi had two reasons as to what the problem might be. One problem might have been shamunis, some oil, shmir, whatever on the knife, which then gets absorbed into the radish, not just left on the surface, but fully absorbed into the snow because of its harifus. Or if it was absorbed, there was balua in the knife, and the radish, the harifus, the spiciness of the radish, was able to pull out that tam, get it out of the knife, and then into the radish. We said there's not three-way machlokas in Rishonim that ended up being brought down in the Shulchan Aruch as to how much of the food actually absorbs the taste, the three shitos. Does anybody remember what the three options were? Good, which is the kadei klipa, the rush. Very good, 2 centimeters, right, which is the kadei mitila of the rivid. And finally, the Rosh goes kulo. We said the Rosh, but said I would be noted this way, but the Rabbi doesn't say this, so I can't really pass it that way. And then in his Kitzer Sefer, he went all the way and said, no, I think the fact is that the taste is absorbed the kulo. So how was this brought down? Le'alacha, Machlokas, Mechaber, Ma, Ashkenaz, and Sfardim. Pretty classic. For all like the smaller scale Machlokas, seems like the Ashkenazim had Dola Chumra, and then for like two huge, in general Ashkenazim Dola Chumra, and then there are like two huge areas of Kashas where Sfardim Dola Chumra, and those two areas really like make up for all the other smaller Ashkenazim Chumra. It's pretty funny. This doesn't happen so often, like it doesn't impact so many cases, and there are a bunch of situations like this, but the Sfardim, the two big ones we talk about are number one for Shita, the lungs. They're much more knocking on lungs to get the status of glass to be a full hefter. Anything which is found on a lung, according to this writing, is going to be a problem. Perhaps an asthma, as long as you're able to like scrape it off, basically, and without finding a hole underneath, then you'd be fine. So that definitely reduces the amount of glass pollution caused you by. And the other one is bishlakim. Well, we'll talk about bishlakim in a couple of weeks, but there's a huge chumrah when it comes to bishlakim, which makes Sephardi restaurants more expensive and just harder to operate, especially in Sutzlaret, makes things a lot more complicated. So us Ashkenazim can handle a couple of chumras, because the big stuff really equals out. So the mechaber said we pass in today the kila. That means if you cut an onion, let's say, with a fleshik knife, you can take a pirate knife and cut off from the bottom of that same onion and get a slice of a good bishmak slice of onion to use in your dairy quiche and your, I don't know, whatever dairy food you make, put it on your pizza, whatever's good. The Ramah has a luchasina, but the Ebed is big choshesh for the mountain or shita, even though he recognizes that mikra adin, we do pass him like that middle shita, the kedei nitila. Luchasina, you should assume, kulo, like the Rashba, but the Ebed, meaning after the fact, if the onion already got mixed into the food, then you can rely on the nitila. Bidiyev really comes into play for questions of bittul. If I dropped an onion in a dairy soup that had been cut with a plastic knife, how much time do I need to be in the vatel? So the Ramah would tell you, this is the case of Bidiyev, it's already been cooked together, so the Ramah would say you only need to be in the vatel at the day of tila as opposed to the volume of the entire onion. Which does help, definitely does help in terms of finding out bittul. We spoke about that test question, right? The Ashkenazi party. If you have a cream cheese sandwich and you put on a slice of onion that was cut with a plastic knife, you have to realize that we're getting from the Ashkenazi as opposed to this party. That was a great question. Okay, so one of the things we wanted to talk about was Eidu Ben Yomo. Most cases, we actually have this chazaka, or this assumption, you have to assume, in most cases, is that Kalim are generally Eidu Ben Yomo. Jewish Kalim, non-Jewish Kalim, doesn't matter. Unless you know otherwise, Kalim are assumed to be Eidu Ben Yomo. Most cases, most of the time, you're calling up your rabbi for a question. Hey, rabbi, I know this, like, I don't know how this happened, but I was making soup and I used this knife with this onion and cooked it in this pot, ba ba ba. Usually, unless you know otherwise, you're able to assume that it has not been used, within 24 hours, and that adds a huge layer of kula to most cases. Right? We say that after 24 hours, any taste which is absorbed in a kli becomes tam kavum. It's no longer positive taste, and we don't really want it to be absorbed into our food. It's a negative impact on our food as opposed to a positive impact, and therefore it's not nechshav. It's not really taken into account at all. The one possible exception for that is with davar pari. So the context of this machloket comes from a Gemara in Avodah Zarah discussing a spice known as chiltis. Is that a modern Hebrew spice? Is that something that you've heard of? No. So there's a spice discussed in chiltis. It's like the most tart spice in the world. How spicy is the most tart spice in the world, you might ask? So according to the Gemara, if a cow eats a chiltis spice, it is a suffix treta. It may have burned a hole in its stomach. That's pretty great. So harp is the most spiciest spice in the world. It's wild. My first NCS Live Shabbat Tone, no, it was my first Spring Regional NCS Live Shabbat Tone. I was an advisor in upstate New York when it was run by a fantastic person named Mark Fine. And on Sunday morning, I don't know what you do Sunday morning, get people energized, get a long Shabbos, and nobody really had anything the night before. It's like, how do you get people excited? Obviously, you have a jalapeno pepper eating contest. This is like totally spontaneous. I think if I remember correctly, Mark just found a bag of jalapeno peppers in the kitchen. He's like, this sounds like a great idea. He got everybody on the regional to line up and just started handing out jalapeno peppers. I got like 5 and there was some girl who got 11. It was wild. It was really insane. One of the advisors, like, without a problem, just ate 11 jalapeno peppers. It was really nuts. So chiltis can burn a hole in a cow's stomach, which is pretty wild. So there, in the context of chiltis, the Gemara says that Eidu Ben Yomo is irrelevant, and any Eidu Ben Yomo tastes which come in contact with chiltis, which are mixed with chiltis, are presumed to have been rehabilitated and become Bnei Yomo, or have become sweetened, I don't know, are no longer a negative taste. So the question is that something which is unique to the spiciest spice in the world, this chiltis, Or is that something that's just true for all Dabar Harit, Dabarim, Haritim, that just happens to be the context of that Gemara was this chiltis spice? But it would apply to onions, it would apply to ginger, it would apply to, I don't know, lemons, whatever else you want to say is Dabar Harit. We gave a list last week. With that same didn't apply. So this is the Machlokas between two Rishonim, the Maharam, and the Sefer Truma, yes.
How long does Dabar Harit then begin?
Seems like there's no limit. It's a good question. It seems like there's no limit. Something is either Ben Yomo or Ein Ben Yomo. We don't really say there's like Ein Ben Shvuo, Ein Ben Chodesh. It's just Ben Yomo, Ein Ben Yomo, and it doesn't really go away. Yes.
Did anyone mention it in the year that
Yeah, there is something where Moshe has a heter after 12 months. There's something about 2 months in some place. 12 months is a more accepted one. I don't know. That the heter will be applied as a sniff. I'm not sure if it really... I don't think we saw anywhere in the primary sources that works. I'm not sure what Moshe's source was. I obviously had one. I just don't know what it was. Chiltis is like Ches Yud Lamed Tav Yud Tav. Chiltis. Spiciest in the world. Yeah, so this is the machlokas between the Maharam and the Sefer HaTruma. So the Mechaber actually brings down both. This is something that he'll do every once in a while. We have a problem trying to figure out how does the Mechaber paskin when he does something like this. When he brings down multiple shittos, which one does he actually feel is one we're supposed to be notified? So one of those rules is machlokas. If he brings someone stam, just quotes their opinion without attributing it to anybody, and then he says, Yesh Omrim, a different shita, who we pass him like?
No.
Pass him like the stam. Very good. Why did he bring the Yesh Omrim? That's a good question. I'm not sure. But in general, when the Mahabra does that, it means he passed him like the stam. That's what he does here. He brings the Maharam, the more kuda, the makel shita, as the stam. He brings the Sefer HaTruma as the Yesh Omrim, the more master shita. So as far as they are comfortable relying on the Maharam, Eino b'yomo, even with Dabar Harit, means that we have no problem, no issue. The only time, for Sephardim, that a Dabar Harit is going to cause problems is when you're dealing with a taste which is b'yomo absorbed in the knife. So what does that mean? If the last time I use a knife, a place of knife to cut an onion, if the last time that knife has been used with contemplation was more than 24 hours ago, a Sephardim will say that onion is still fired. Alright, say that again. If I use a flaking knife to cut an onion, if the last time that knife has been used with hot meat, it needs to be meat which is yet to let us go, if the last time it was used with hot meat was more than 24 hours ago, even for the first party, that onion remains totally hard. Ashkenazim take on the chumrah, be safer, hatruma, and say that, nope, we're going to consider it to be benyomo. It's as if the taste has been rehabilitated, and therefore it's fully meat. So we have two big chumras within Dabar Harit for Ashkenazim. Number one, the rashva, the taste goes through the entire thing that was just cut. The onion is now full of meat as opposed to just a kadeh in a kilo of meat. And einu benyomo as opposed to benyomo. Even if the knife is einu benyomo, we still assume that the taste is fully rehabilitated and it's tam shvach and therefore is a problem.
Has there been raised questions and problems for Ashkenazim to be as far as
Fantastic question. Very good. This comes up all over the place. This is a huge question even by Hilton Shabbos, right? Anytime an Asfardi wants to have an Ashkenazi over for a meal, what's the big kula that some Asfardi have in terms of eating a food on Shabbos? Yes, very good. So the question of, is there visual after visual to double lash? So let's say you want to have hatsuk on Shabbos day. I'm not sure why, it doesn't happen so often, but let's say you want to have hatsuk on Shabbos day. So some Sfardim, not all Sfardim, but some Temanim, that's okay, Temanim is based on the Rambam, Temanim, let's say, are able to take, for them it's full-fledged, fine, so we'll talk about that. Temanim are able to take a full pot of soup that's cold and put it, since obviously it's been cooked already, and put it onto the plaza, put it onto the hot plate to warm it back up, because they hold ein bishalach harishol dabar lash. Ashkenazim definitely do not hold that way. They say ein bishalach harishol dabar lash. Ashkenazim say yesh bishalach harishol dabar lash. That is considered recooking the soup, and that would be a problem. So how can a Temani have an Ashkenazi over and serve them soup if they're heating up soup on Shabbos? even within like a more mainstream Sephardi exam, there's a difference in terms of a solid which is sitting in liquid, which is like sitting in gravy. For Ashkenazim, you need to shake off whatever gravy is on, let's say like chicken and sauce or something. For Ashkenazim, you need to shake off whatever sauce, even if it's congealed, you want to get it as dry as possible. For Sephardim, you are able to put, again, check your local Orthodox Sephardi rabbi, but at least my wife's minhag was that at Sakla's, you're able to take the pan with the sauce, with whatever it is, the sauce is basically muscle from the chicken itself, and you can put it right onto the hot plate, and it's going to be warming up, it's going to be coming hot. You're ending up with hot liquid, but for Sephardim, that doesn't matter. So, how can a Sephardi have an Ashkenazi over for Shabbat lunch if they're going to be doing all these things? It seems like for the Sephardi, it's totally fine and kosher. For the Ashkenazi, it's straight. What's going on? So, luckily, we have this concept of this positive potential for two psukim to be fully correct, fully right, fully MS, even though for A would be the wrong thing to do, for B, it's the right thing to do. So as long as this party is doing it for himself, as long as what he's doing is fully mutter, as the fact that says this is what you meant to rely on, and generally, we think that the other person is able to rely on it also, is able to benefit from the lacha that was done. That does not mean you can call your Sephardi neighbor and ask him to put your cold soup on the bless for you. That does not work. That's him acting as your shliach, and he needs to follow your halachos. But if you're being invited over to his house, he's the one cooking for you. That's true for Ezen Kashrus and for Shabbos also, all these things. If he's the one doing the lacha for himself, and you're not a bystander, you're a byproduct, you're like a you have to be able to get the benefit from the blessing he's doing for himself, then that's a different story. Yes? Can you use the kudos for Rav Ashkenazi? That I don't think works. That I don't think works. Yeah. No, that's a good question. Okay, so the Ramah, we said, was the Ramah was explicit by Inu Ben Yomo, we hold it to paper at Truma, Sabar Paras is going to remain Inu Ben Yomo. A very relevant detail, I think we mentioned this quickly last time, but we need to talk about it a little bit more. You cut an onion with a salacious knife. So for an Ashkenazi, that onion is fully considered meat, even if it was Inu Ben Yomo, none of that matters. The Kli remains Inu Ben Yomo. So the knife that I used remains Inu Ben Yomo. Another example, a fallacious frying pan. This happens all the time. If I use a fallacious frying pan to fry onions. So we said, post facto, once the onions are done frying, they're no longer hard. If I then cut them with some sort of a cleaver, put them into another pot or anything like that, they're no longer hard. Normal rules would apply at that point. But while they start off frying, the beginning of the process, they are still hard. You will still have a problem. They will still be absorbing. Even Inu Ben Yomo will still be absorbing from the fallacious frying pan. So what happens there? In that case too, the fallacious frying pan will remain Inu Ben Yomo. Inu Ben Yomo. Yeah, that's a shach in Kufchav Beis, Sifkat and Beis. That's later on in Shulchan Aruch. Right now we're by Tzadi Vav, but this is brought up a little bit later on. The question that we had was, what happens if you use an Inu Ben Yomo meat spatula to mix onions that have not yet been fully fried, so they're still considered hard. You use an Inu Ben Yomo meat spatula to mix onions, so now those onions we know are meat, and then you use that same spatula to flip a cheese omelet. So what would the dip be there?
You're frying onions
in a par pan. You use a Inu Ben Yomo meat spatula to mix the onions. And then then you use the spatula to flip a dairy, like a cheese omelet. Right, so what might you have thought? These onions become fully placed, right? Not only not they're not placed, they're fully placed. So what is this law?
Meat spatula.
So then you may have thought that the not onions would give over a not taste to the spatula, and then the spatula would give that super hard, fallacious taste into the dairy omelet and actually trick up the omelet. So in terms of Tzachus tip of the Eved, that's not what happens. The omelet remains hard. The normal rules of not transferring time are due to apply. Right, so from onion to spatula, spatula to omelet is still a not for not, even though onions are the thing which you're giving the taste over, that doesn't mean you have to start using onion rules. So say that again, the rules of Dover Fire only upon when you're interacting with the Dover Fire itself, not when you get another step removed from the onion. So in our example, the spatula does not have charis flaky taste, it just has flaky taste. Therefore, when you get to the spatula, it's not for not of meat, and therefore you're fine. Still make as in, still a chachila, before you use it with the dairy, you should have kashered it. Definitely brushing out, and you should have kashered it before causing this not for not taste. But make as in, you have not tricked up the omelet. At this point, you really should still kasher that spatula, because you have two bulios in there. You have your Edubin Yomo Felicia bulia, and you have a new dairy bulia, so you should definitely kasher that spatula, but the omelet would remain kosher. Yes.
Cheese omelet?
The cheese omelet, yeah, fully cheese omelet.
Would you use a normal spatula
in
cheese omelet, fine?
If you use a normal, no, do not do that. Not saying otherwise, not doing that right there.
Even if it's not Edubin
Yomo? If it's Edubin Yomo, then Bidi Ebed, you'd be okay.
And you need a kosher.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, you still need a kasher. This was when we spoke 2 weeks ago. We spoke about using the wrong type with using the wrong pot with the wrong food. So that's what we said, that if you're in a binyomo, then bid the evidence post facto, you're fine. But you still need a kasher with kli, because now you have bulios of two different types in the same kli, and the next time you use it, you're going to have them mixed together.
So that's the whole first time you use the meat in the deer, though, is that considered trace yet?
Since the time is in a binyomo, it's not able to be, it doesn't positively affect the food, and even though they get mixed, you're mixing new taste with old taste, and there's no real fusion there, but the next time you use it on purpose, what you're effectively doing is purposely using Einu Binyomo taste, whichever one, doesn't matter what you use it with, you're purposely using Einu Binyomo taste with the wrong type. But there was a discussion about maybe parv. Maybe you could use that pile of parv. I think we say that generally you should not do that. We don't accept that sheet. It just like looks very, very confusing. Like, we know that this is either a flaky pot or a dairy pot. How can you tell me that it's parv? Doesn't make any sense. But there was at least a discussion to say that since both tastes are going to be in a binyomo, it shouldn't be a problem. But I think we generally say don't do that. Your best move with hachila is to kasher the spatula, kasher that pot, whatever you use is the wrong type. If it was any binyomo, the food itself was fine, but before using it again, you should kasher it. Kasher we'll speak about, generally that's going to mean hagala. Once in a long while, you may need one, but generally that's going to mean hagala. Okay? Good. Spoke about if you already did it. Ooh, this is a good question. If you remove onions fried in a fleshic pan with a dairy spatula, what happens there? You have a fleshic pan frying onions. We said post facto, the onions that were fried are no longer binyomon. But when they started getting fried, they were taken in time as if it was binyomon. So you remove onions fried in a fleshic pan with a dairy spatula. So what's in there? Assuming they're still hot, because you can't give over taste if it's cold, that's a good point. So assuming they are still hot, what question do you need to ask?
Is it milk?
Yes, very good. The question you need to find out is that milk sponge you're using, binyomo or Edubin Yomo? Why is that such a big factor here?
Because if it is
binyomo,
you're
thinking... Well, because what are we dealing with beside the onions? The onions are no longer Dover Fire. So the Einu Binyomo is going to be a huge factor once again. So what happens? If the dairy spatula is Einu Binyomo, then the onions remain fleshic and mutter, right? They do get the infusion of dairy taste, but it's Einu Binyomo dairy taste, so they're fine. The dairy spatula gets a ton of basar from the onions. They do have that infusion of meat from the onions themselves, and therefore that spatula needs to be koshered. So it's both dairy and not bar not meat, so hachila needs to be kashered before you use it again. If that spatula was ben yomo, what are the onions taking in? They're taking ben yomo milchic tam, which strafes up both the spatula and the onion and the pan. That's really bad. Go throw out the onions, kasher everything, and stop using ben yomo. You said stop cutting down to yourself.
Okay. Onions are working.
Awesome. They're blazing, they're right there. You strafe them up. Okay, well, another one. If you fry onions in a flaky pan, and then you, and then you cook them in a pot of pot. Fry onions in a flaky pan, and then you transfer them from the pan into a pot. For some reason, all the recipes call for first fry the onion, and then transfer them to the pot. Just number one, labor intensive. Number two, more juice to wash. And number three, so many more halakha problems. I don't know why they do that. It's like the kosher one. Kosher cookbooks make you do this stuff. I don't get it. So what's the status of the parah pot?
When you put the onions in, it's probably not in the bottom of the onion.
Good.
They shake.
Okay. Do I need to put this plastic sticker on my power pot now, or can I keep it as a power pot? So let's say I want to cook noodles in the pot. Right? I want to cook noodles in that power pot. What would the status of those noodles be? What? Carve noodles in a pot which cooks plastic onions.
Oh, are you cooking the noodles with the
onions? No, not together with the onions. I want to put in hard noodles. What would the status of those noodles be? Is it the same as that, or is it a little bit different? We have to count the knots, right? The onions are one, right? Because the onions have rehabilitated Fleishik Khan from the frying pan, now they're put into the meat pot. So the meat pot absorbed they're absorbing not far not from the onion. And now I'm putting in noodles, how many cases removed is it? It's not far not, far not. The third step removed. So even Ashkenazim are allowed to cook meat in this, they're allowed to cook noodles, they're allowed to cook parib in this at one point higher pot. It would still be a problem to use the chachego as milk and food. We're not so confident to say that not for not for not totally gets rid of the problem. There's a shita like that. But we're not going to say that for dairy. But for parib, it's totally fine. You have a not for not for not in those noodles, and then if you put cheese on it, we don't care about that. You're totally fine. That would be okay. So you can still use that pot for more for straight parib, cook zucchini, cook noodles, all the other fish and vegetables you have in your house. You can cook that, but you just can't cook dairy. You just can't cook dairy in that pot. You shouldn't be doing that anyway, because that's your parib pot, so no problem. Okay, good. Yeah. Hey, done?
So you're able to put cheese and anything else after you
take it out? After you take it out of the pot, you can add cheese to that. That would be totally fine. Not far not far not. Would not be an issue to mix with dairy. Even we already said definitely for Ashkenazim post facto and Spartan, one sense of hafila. So yeah, once you have three steps removed, then we assume you're okay. And just to remind ourselves, we had said that there are two different ways to see what happens each time you have a not or not. You have one taste removed. What exactly happens? We said that it's not that the taste stops getting transferred. It's just a very weak taste. And each step removed, it's weaker and weaker and weaker. And that does have impact, just not to think that it totally disappears. The reason that was relevant is because if you're dealing with a trait, then no matter how many knots you have, it is still going to be a problem.
Would you just eat those noodles in that pot with uncooked onions? That can change
anything? Uncooked onions, but you cook it? You cook
the noodles, you cook in the pot that you cook the meat?
No, it's... Oh, with cheese.
Would it be in figures of tiny amounts?
With cheese?
Yeah, with cheese, like plain onions and cheese. Then figures of meat and cheese that is not right on.
At that point, let's see, what would you have to rely on? We don't really say in a binyomo when it comes to food. On the other hand, if we have time. There's one funny sheet that we don't really use, so you probably can use that one either. Can you switch cheese? We have to be cooked. Yeah, I know. I hear the question, I'm not sure. Sorry. I think we mentioned last time, we did the ima, we spoke about the ima. Cooking karif and kuyen binyomo. Cutting board. Important to know that lechachila, meat or dairy cutting board, also contributes to tam. So for Davar Charev, let's take our onion, is cut with a parve knife on a meat cutting board, then the onion should be treated as meat. Bidi Evet, if you already use that onion with either parve or milchek, probably with milchek, Bidi Evet, you could rely on the shittas that disagree, but there is at least a chance, there is at least one shita that we generally try to rely on that says that the cutting board contributes meat taste to the onion. I think we say even the kalim. Yeah, I think we say even the knife becomes whatever the cutting board was. And lechachila again, b'di'evet, that would not be true. But let me see if I can find it quickly, because that's an important one. Yeah. Yeah, it's complicated. It may even impact the other kli. Halacha l'maaseh we say it's ra'i lahakpid, but b'di'evet Rebbe Eliashiv was mako. So get yourself three cutting boards for your house. You need a place for one, cut all that meat that you're buying. Milk for one. Nobody really cuts milk so much unless you're like a cheese guy. You don't really need a milk cutting board. It doesn't come up so much, I think. Then parve is definitely most relevant. Get yourself a parve knife and parve cutting board and make sure you're cutting all your harishim with your parve knife on your parve cutting board. Don't mess around. It's not worth it. Like you said, if you ever cut onions, either with your flasher knife, or now we just found out on your flasher cutting board, hopefully use like a disposable knife or something, just put that onion in a bag, mark it as flasher, mark it as meat, and use it the next time you need onions in a meat recipe. Yeah.
So onions become meat in the cutting board, but you don't have to wait any time.
Right. That we said as Rebbe Akiva Eiger on the test. So that you don't, that all the stuff about B'liyat Tam, about the Bechart, was not going to trigger, is not going to make you wait yet. Okay, good.
And the same is for like noodles that you cut with meat, knife?
No.
Like when you shred off?
So let's talk about non-charif foods. That's the very end of the simon. What happens when you cut non-charif foods with a meat or milk knife? Are any of these even relevant, any of this stuff worth talking about, or you can just go on with your life, no problems? So if you cut non-charif foods with a knife of either type, you need to scrape off the edge. Right? We assume that there's some sort of shamnunis on the edge of the knife. It's hard to get knives clean, like we've been assuming this entire simon. So there is some solid, there is some remnants left on the edge of the knife, and therefore you need to scrape the edge, both edges of whatever you cut, and then the entire food remains parve. The big difference between davar charev and non-davar charev is that by davar charev there's a absorption of that tam, whereas that's not true by a non-davar charev food. Cucumbers, noodles, tomatoes, all these things are good. You just scrape off the edge. You may have thought that just like washing off the fruit would be enough, that the edge would be enough just to get out the shamnunis. It seems like it really depends on the type of food. The foods that the Gemara was talking about were porous. If you wash off something porous, the Gemara was assuming that the taste, that would cause the taste to be absorbed. That's why they said you should just scrape off this fat, the shamnunis, with the edge of a knife blade, or a sharp edge. I'm not sure if there are things where washing would work. It seems like generally we just scrape off the edge if necessary. We stay by fish. Fish are a little bit different. If you take a knife and start scraping off the edge of the fish, what do you think is going to happen to your fish? You're losing half the fish. You're going to be like cutting along, chunks are going to be falling off. We don't want you to have to lose chunks of your fish. So instead there, we said you can wash the edges with a hard sponge. You can abrasive sponge. If you have steel wool, that would be good. Something hard that's really getting the shamnunis off the side, you can just wash it off and scrub well. But we don't want you like taking chunks off the edge of your fish and losing your fish that way. So just do that. This is something which actually used to be much more lamaiser than it is nowadays, especially for people who live in Jewish communities and Jewish neighborhoods. Let's say you want to get a fish from the non-kosher fish store. Right, so what they usually do is they fillet it for you. It's pretty difficult to clean a fish on your own. You've got to get all the bones out, the ribs and all the stuff, and the gills, disgusting. So usually what they'll do is they'll clean it for you at the store, cut into nice little sections, you don't have to deal with like that eye that just stares at you, and you can take home like nicely prepared fish. But doesn't that mean you're using whatever knife that they have? Fish stores will always have catfish sitting right next to salmon, next to perch, sitting next to tuna. Like, how can you know? You cannot know that they haven't used that knife within 24 hours, any of those non-kosher varieties. What's going to happen? So generally what people would do is they would bring knives from home, This is normal. They'd bring knives from home to the fish store, hand it over the counter, watching them the entire time, obviously, select one of the whole fishes? One of the whole fish? Select one of the whole fish that's sitting in the counter. Obviously, it can't be a cut one, so then that's a problem. But one of the whole fish that's still on the counter, doesn't need to be live, could be dead. He puts it on the counter, and using your knife, he'll do the filleting and the chopping and the cutting and the cleaning, all that stuff. Wrap it up for you, give you your knife back, and you can take your fish home. If that's not an option, if that wasn't available, they don't do that for some reason, they don't accept knives from strangers, not a bad policy. If for whatever reason they're not going to do that, then you are still allowed to buy fish from that fish store. And what you need to do is every cut edge, you need to wash with that abrasive sponge and a steel wool, whatever we said, to get the shahunas off the edge. So that used to be very relevant, halakha l'maisa. Not as much nowadays, but if you go live in, I don't know, Albany has a Jewish, has a kosher grocery store. What's like a boondocks? What's that in boondocks town? Saskatchewan. What's like the go-to? You go to Saskatchewan, they probably don't have a kosher fish store. You would have to do this, and there's a discussion somewhere else where they're most clear. If you have to choose between like never having fish in your entire life because you live in this place and buying fish, which ends up relying on b'di'evet, we allow you to rely on b'di'evet. It's considered b'di'evet to not be able to take advantage of this food for your entire life, and therefore you would be allowed to rely on it. This came up in a different situation. If goyim sell radishes, and the only way to get radishes, which we assume to be devar karef, is basically they're cutting them, you are allowed to buy them. You're allowed to buy radishes from goyim based on a spec statement. Number one, if they cut it with a knife, first of all, there's a chance it got cut not from a knife, with a shovel that they were using to pull it out of the ground. Apparently that was their MO, that's how they work. It was usually cut with a shovel that's cutting out of the ground. It may have also been cut with a straight knife, but you don't know that for sure. So that's subject number one. Subject number two was, even if it was a knife, what can you assume about the knife? Same assumption we have for all kalim, in a yom. So when you put those two together, we allow you to buy radishes from non-Jews. The Ramah said, even if you know that it was cut with a knife, so you lose that spec feka, you can still buy the radish and you just cut off a kadein etila. Why is that surprising that the Rambam was okay with the Kadei Nekila? Good, because Ashkenazi's fact that they needed the kulo, the taste gets absorbed into the entire thing. The Rambam was basically saying, abstaining from radishes your entire life is too much. We can't ask the person to never have radishes. I don't know how recently I've had radishes, and it's not my favorite food, but the Rambam did not want to tell anybody that they cannot have radishes for their entire life. So he said, you would be allowed to buy this radish and rely on it and call it the b'di'evet, just cut off the kadei nekila on either side, and it would be fine. So we see similar here. Now the fish, even though you are relying on the b'di'evet, instead of getting a fully kosher fish, you have this fish with treif shamunin, will allow you to rely on the b'di'evet and just scrape off the edges. So that's a big one.
We're saying scrape off the edges of the food, yeah?
Of the cut edges of the fish, yeah. If we're dealing with fish, yeah. That's where that's wash off. Scraping off is for non-fish foods, cucumbers and the like, things like that.
And then cutting four dishes.
What do you mean? By the guy? Yes. Mistama, yeah. Mistama, yeah. That's good to put down like plastic or something. Good point. I've never had to do this, so. Chicago. And one more thing, you're allowed to buy fruit platters from non-kosher stores, most of the bigger ones. Most fruit platters or fruit counters are, first of all, most fruit platters are made up of non-kosher foods. We mentioned that citrus is kind of the one exception. Some fruit platters will have citrus, and citrus should be considered double kosher, lit, kilo. If you have the choice, or if you have the option of not having citrus foods cut by a trafe knife, you should definitely take that option. And you shouldn't be even buying fruit platters, which have carbs mixed in from a non-kosher store. So most fruit platters are not, don't involve double carb fruits. And in addition to that, the most fruit counters have designated knives. They're not tossing their knives around the store from the meat counter to the dairy counter to the fish counter to the fruit counter. Usually they each have their own designated knives, and that's something we rely on, I think also by the radish case. They usually had designated knives for those purposes. So you would be allowed to buy fruit platters from non-kosher stores. theoretically that might come up by restaurants also, by like a restaurant salad bar. The big problem you need to be aware of by a restaurant salad bar, aside from bug issues, you're never going to get, you're never really going to get around bug issues, but I guess depending on what food you're dealing with, you have to be aware of what is next to the things that you want to take in a salad bar. You see this all the time. You have like the shrimp section in the salad bar, because like that's a good topping on salad apparently. And then like right next to that you have the cucumbers. So every fifth person who's not careful is either switching the tongs from one to the other, or he's dropping pieces of shrimp into the cucumbers. Not a good matzo, you should probably just avoid that. But definitely you need to be aware of what's next to what. If you're going to be using a non-kosher salad bar, definitely should be avoided if possible. But business lunches, things come up, ask your rabbi for hadrava. But at least be aware of that's an additional thing to think about if that ever comes up. Okay, that's it. Scrap, guys.